What kind of day is it? It's a White Claw day. Light and refreshing tasting. Uniquely cold wave filter. There's an iconic flavor for everyone. Come on, grab a pack. White Claw. Grab life by the claw. Please drink responsibly. Hard seltzer with flavor. White Claw seltzer works Chicago, Illinois.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
First, tell me again the hostage story, because it's such a great story. So you were basically kidnapped.
We knew there was a problem, because this is a tinted black Jeep, government plates, rolling around, no cars allowed. And anybody who's seen one bad Hollywood spy movie is like, okay, government plate tinted Jeep, this is a problem. Let's get out of here. The guy gets in my face really, really close, really aggressive, and goes, in your country, can you walk around with just no identification and no passport? Tell me the goddamn truth. And I'm thinking, do I tell him the truth, which is actually I don't need to do that at all, or do I admit some sort of wrongdoing that makes me look even worse for not following the law? So I decided, screw it, I'm just going to be honest. And I said, yeah, we don't need any form of identification at all. And he turns to his friend in Serbia, and he goes, I guess they really are truly free over there. I had no idea. The cops would say something like, you guys, Americans, all you guys do is screw with our country and like bomb us. You're trying to destroy us. We're going to destroy you. We're going to send you back to your CIA friends in a body bag.
We've discussed this before, but I want to kind of go over this story again. Like, you have kind of this epic story of when you were held hostage.
That's right.
And you talked your way out of it.
Yeah.
And then I want to talk about that. But then I also want to talk about, this is something I think about a lot. Like, I interview so many fascinating guests, and you've interviewed many more. I mean, you're up to episode, what is it, like 400 or 500 or something?
Yeah, 500 and some. I should probably know this off the top of my head, but I think
I should probably know it off the top of
my head. It's probably like 530 interviews, plus I have the mini-sodes on Monday, plus I have Fan Mail Friday. And
I was episode 300. I was
That's right.
Yeah, I was like a pivotal episode. But I always try to get at least a couple of takeaways from each podcast I do, because you're not just doing a podcast for the entertainment of others, I'm trying to learn in the podcast from my guest. And so I try to say to myself, what am I learning from this? And so I want to hear how you learn and what you've learned from most of your guests. And I have some guests in particular in mind. But again, your theme of your podcast is about, charm is almost the wrong word, because that sounds very almost like 1800s, the art of charm, which I like in terms of naming.
Stylistically.
But it's really about, you know, kind of persuasion, likability, authenticity. Mm-hmm. And I want to kind of ask you about that and what you've learned from some key guests.
Definitely, yeah.
But first, tell me again the hostage story, because it's such a great story. So you were basically kidnapped.
Yeah, so I used to be a teacher in Serbia, which is
like
former
anybody.
Yugoslavia. Like anybody, back when we were all teachers in the former Yugoslavia. And I was there, and I had this, the people paying for my job over there was the U.S. Department of Defense, and they have this educational arm.
Like, it's not often.
Yeah.
So you've said like five things in the past two sentences. Department of Defense paid for me to be a teacher in Serbia.
Right.
Like, what the heck?
Well, the same line of thinking also was had by the local, I should say, state security officers. So they have an office there. The Department of Defense has an office there that's part of their educational wing. And to be fair, it's like, you know what a Fulbright is?
Yeah.
So this is like the same path as Fulbright. Usually people do this and then they apply for a Fulbright in the same area and they get it or you know, they don't get it, whatever. And I applied for this and I got it and I went to Serbia and I just assumed that whoever was working in that same building or those police, they just know who's going in and out of there and they keep tabs on those people.
But why did you want to do this?
Well, I had already been to Serbia as an English teacher privately for a year prior to that.
So you were making a living teaching English to other countries.
I was making a really crappy living. I think I got paid like 100 euros per month, which is, you know, not a lot of money. I mean, just say, let's say it's $120 at that time per month. You can't survive anywhere on that at all. So I was basically coming out of pocket to do it, but I was killing time between undergrad and law school. And then after the first year of law school, you're supposed to do something with your summer that's relative to, you know, relevant at all to your growth or anything. So I applied for this fellowship and got it. And it was pretty prestigious fellowship in terms, as far as all of academic getting, as far as getting money from the government to go and screw around for a summer, it's a pretty, like, it looks good on paper.
Note to self.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to do it.
Exactly. And so I went there and they just kind of went, this guy's a spy. And
right, CIA fellowship hang out with Serbians.
Exactly. And they're kind of like, what's this guy's angle? And so they were showing up at places where I was supposed to be living, and I had to register with the police as a foreign national working there. And I had all kinds of problems with visas and all kinds of problems with other issues. Luckily, I could, at that point, since I was with the government fellowship, call the U.S. Embassy and go there and stop by, and then they would make a call to some police chief and I would get all my stuff handled. But that still didn't look that good to their internal security, who's like, okay, so this random teacher, it has a Department of Defense scholarship, and the second we give him any issues with his work visa,
the ambassador calls up.
Some guy who's like, yeah, the assistant to the U.S. ambassador's secretary calls the chief of police and pulls some strings, and he walks in with, like, you know, instead of waiting 5 months, he walks in and walks out with a stamp of paper and a business card. Like, this isn't how this is supposed to work. And their state security, it's not like our FBI, where they're like, look, we're just making sure everything's okay. These are a lot of times these militia guys from Bosnia that got pushed out for all these atrocities and their village has been burned to the ground. So now they work in Serbia, in Belgrade, or in some other part of Serbia as their internal security. And there's certain laws on the books, at least at that time, that said those guys were above the law. And it doesn't, I'm sure, say that, but basically they're immune from prosecution. And the reason that they did that was because the UN was trying to get Serbia to prosecute these people. And it's hard to harbor a criminal inside a country, but it's easier to say, look, these people have all been granted immunity from anything that may or may not have happened by previous administrations, and we can't go back on that. So that they kind of just went around doing drugs and terrorizing people. And it happened, I wasn't just lucky as a foreigner, I was kind of, but there are other people in Serbia that when this happened to me and I told all my friends, they were like, oh yeah, you know, my uncle got beat up because he owns a farm equipment importing business and he wouldn't pay them. Or like, oh yeah, you know, my friend imports Legos and they stole a bunch of his stuff and he's like screwed, and he got screwed out of like an annual salary worth of stuff because they just like took the shipment. Mm. They're just bastards. And I was at a concert and they were rolling around looking for people and they found me and my friend. And my friend also, they had hit the jackpot because my friend, his dad was an old organized crime figure from Serbia back in the day, friends with this guy named Arkan who got assassinated and was like this arms dealer
guy. So that didn't buy him any kind of goodwill with the next generation of gangsters?
No, I guess it was kind of the opposite where like they're like, oh yeah, you're part of these guys that like are gone now. We're the new show in town. And he had a big mouth. He was the opposite of Art of Charm. Whereas he was kind of like, you know,
this is your friend.
This is any, yeah. My friend was like, you know, I can, you guys are in trouble. You guys have no idea what's going to happen to you. And they're just like, who's holding the gun right now, punk? You know, and I was.
So wait, you were in the concert and they found you. Did they just like take you out physically of the concert, or did they say, come with us? Or
so there's no cars allowed on this island. The island, I can't remember the name of it, but it's an old Turkish fortress from the Ottoman Empire on an island. So it's like Game of Thrones style place. Although there's no roof or anything. It's, you know, open air. And I think it holds like 140,000 people or something ridiculous. It's just huge. And they're driving around in this car, and there's no cars allowed on the whole island. I mean, it's a music festival. It doesn't have a street. There's the UN had bombed, or the US or whoever had bombed the bridge that goes to it. So there's a military bridge that's like floating temporary, but it's been like a decade and a half. And so we knew there was a problem because this is a tinted black Jeep, government plates, rolling around, no cars allowed. And anybody who's seen one bad Hollywood spy movie is like, okay, government plate tinted Jeep, this is a problem. Let's get out of here. And they were looking for somebody. It could have been us, could have just been looking for trouble, but they stopped us and they were like, where are your passports? And so we showed our passports because you have to carry your passport. The problem is I had a copy of mine. I didn't have my original because you could lose that. And then you're, you know, you don't have your passport in a country where you might want to split. you know? So I said, here's a copy of my passport. And they're like, oh, you're in violation of the law. You have to have your original passport on you at all times as a foreign national living in Serbia. And they're telling me this in English. They don't know I speak Serbian at this point. And the other guy starts to get really mad. It's a little bit bad cop, worse cop. And they go, well, you know, you need to carry your passport. And I'm like, look, sorry, I didn't realize I had to have the original. I've been fine with my copy for a really long time. You know, I live here long term teaching English. It's dangerous to carry my passport because I might lose it. And then the guy gets in my face really, really close, really aggressive, and goes, in your country, can you walk around with just no identification and no passport? Tell me the goddamn truth. And I'm thinking, do I tell him the truth, which is actually I don't need to do that at all, or do I admit some sort of wrongdoing that makes me look even worse for not following the law? So I decide, screw it, I'm just going to be honest. And I said, yeah, we don't need any form of identification at all. And he turns to his friend in Serbian and he goes, I guess they really are truly free over there. I had no idea. And the other guy just goes, damn, is this for real? And so he turns around again and goes, really? No identification anywhere. You can just walk around. And I go, yeah, it's in our constitution. The police cannot ask you for anything like that. You have to identify yourself, but they cannot make you carry any identification. And they just stopped and you could just see like the gears turning in their head where they're just questioning everything that they knew about freedom, right? They thought it was just like a line of BS from some Kenny Loggins song or something like that. And
I like how you pick Kenny Loggins as your representative musician for freedom, but go ahead.
Well, I was thinking,
I think
like,
he lives in Chelsea, by the way.
Top Gun theme song, right? Freedom. Hashtag America. Maybe I'll go. You should get Kenny Loggins on, and he's probably got not so much to talk about in terms of.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know.
There's probably not a lot going on. New York, this whole place, there's show guests.
Podcast
everywhere.
Guests walking all around.
Everywhere. So they're like, all right, well, you're coming with us. And I'm thinking, I really don't want to do this. It's really early in the morning because we had spent all night out at this music festival. And we thought, okay, we're going to have to get in the car. I mean, they're armed. You know, this is what's happening. But you know Gavin De Becker's book, The Gift of Fear?
No.
Well, he basically, this guy went on Oprah a million years ago and said, never go to the secondary location. Because if you go to the secondary location, this is a place where no one can hear you scream and you can't do anything. Now, I had vaguely remembered that in the first time I was actually kidnapped.
What does
in Mexico.
It quite mean, a secondary location?
Oh, so.
And then we're going to get back to the first time you got kidnapped.
Sure, sure. So the secondary location is if I'm seeing you outside this building, right? You're walking out and I'm like, I'm going to grab James Altucher. I got you right there. You're walking out with your iced latte or whatever. I go, come with me. A lot of kidnapped victims are like, crap, okay, I better comply because this person's going to be violent or is armed or something. And somehow when I get there, I'll figure out something else to do. Or on the way there, I'll figure out something else to do. But if we had a graph, you could see the amount of control that person has going up as time progresses and as you get closer to where their quote-unquote hideout is. In the moment that they try to get you, that they accost you, that's the moment at which they have the least amount of control. That's where the most can go wrong. That's where
for them.
And that's where you are probably most familiar with the surroundings because you know where you are and you're not in their vehicle. There's nothing. So the best place to make a stand is right there. Don't get in their car. Don't go to their location because their location is primed. That's where they've got five of their friends, their soundproof basement that has no windows, you know, restraints or whatever it is, locks on the door, other people that are sympathetic to whatever cause they've got. When you're standing outside your door or outside Starbucks or whatever, and they've got something on you, that's the place where you go, I'm just going to scream or I'm going to fight. And then that person most likely will run away, give up, choose a different victim, stab you and run away, or just, you know, who knows. But whatever happens there is going to be better and easier than what happens at the secondary location. Well, I didn't listen to that advice at all because my friend was like, all right, I'm just going to comply. And retrospectively,
what could you have done though? Like you're on a bridge.
Exactly.
It's almost like you already were in a secondary location.
I was already kind of in a pickle. Yeah, for sure. And at that point, I did what most people do when they get assaulted, which is go, this is probably not as bad as I think it is because your brain's trying to keep itself from going overload panic mode. And So I decided, okay, well, I don't want to get in the car. And they wouldn't let us get in the car anyway. There were rifles in the back seat.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt, and sure. I tend to interrupt a lot, but I'm trying to kind of make the metaphor to many situations in life. Like, let's say your boss confronts you, or you're fired, or you're having a problem in a relationship. Are you kind of saying confront right there, or fight confrontation with confrontation? Because often you do comply for a little while because you feel the heat will cool down.
Yeah. I mean,
this obviously is a different situation because there's physical threats involved.
Yeah. I think it's mostly to do with physical threats. I mean, maybe you could stretch the metaphor that far, but I know in this case it is specifically physical confrontation because of the constraints that you have when you're at the other person's location. Like right now, I'm in your recording studio in New York. It's harder for me to get out, know where everything is. And every serial killer movie, right, that you see, if you ever watched Dexter or anything like that, remember those killers would invite, remember the one he's like inviting someone to his weird fun house and there's like barbed wire and mesh everywhere and she's got to crawl through and he's kind of walking slowly after. That's what it's like in the secondary location. The other person has you right where they want you. They set it up that way. There's very little chance of escape. They've thought of everything in that location. They can't control the location where they get you generally, unless you put yourself in a bad place. You know, you're walking down a dark alley. That's why bad things happen in dark alleys. But this, I was on a bridge and I thought, okay, my friend's already complying. They wouldn't let us in the car. There's rifles in the back seat. And so they go stand on the running boards of the car. Do you know what running boards are?
No.
So in a Jeep there or any kind of SUV, there's doors that are maybe a little bit higher off the ground that might be hard to step into. So there's a little step that kind of goes underneath. That's called a running board. So they made us stand on the running boards and hold on to the top of the car, which had a sunroof that they opened, and then we were holding on to that. And I thought, okay, we're going to get somewhere where there's a bunch of people, and I'm just going to, like, get off this car. And that, I thought, was better than trying to run on this island and across this bridge. I mean, there's just no way I was getting away. Because I was already, like you said, at an almost secondary location where there was nowhere for me to go. Like, there were tons of people around on this island, but they were vendors and stuff like that. And a lot of them were like, I don't want to deal with these secret police guys. So they were minding their own business. I thought if we go through town or something, it's going to be harder because I'm just going to scream. Even if nobody tries to help me at that point, they're going to have to drag me back into this Jeep and they're probably just going to be like, screw it. Because someone's going to have a camera phone and it's just not worth it. And so I get on the Jeep, my friend gets on the Jeep, and we're driving, and we're going down the highway, and it's like 40 miles an hour. So I'm thinking, holy crap, I better be careful because you can't just tuck and roll at 40 miles an hour.
What's the highest you can tuck and roll?
I actually don't know. Probably like 10 miles an hour because it looks
slow. Like, what if
you
had jumped out at 40 miles an hour and tried to do the tuck? Like, so the tuck and roll, I guess, is you get in a ball and you roll with it to get the momentum out of you.
Yeah, it would have been like most likely several broken limbs or a busted head or a busted everything. Who knows? So it was so fast that viscerally, I knew that I was not going to be able to do this. And they were driving in multiple lanes of traffic. So even if I had done an awesome Rambo move, there's a good chance I would have just gotten hit by a bus or a car or something else in that lane. So me and my friend were kind of worried and we're really nervous at this point. And the regular police tried to pull over the Jeep. And I thought, oh, thank God, you know, they're going to pull over and we're just going to go, look, these guys are messing with us. You know, call somebody and figure this out, or at least maybe they'll arrest us and we'll go to the police station and it'll be like a normal kind of situation where they're going to go, there's nothing these guys did, or they'll charge us with like riding on the outside of a car on the highway and I'll deal with that. But then these guys unrolled their window and just kind of like waved them away and the cops just pulled over and like didn't do anything. And that's when I thought, holy crap, this is real. Like, these are real guys with real authority that are just abusing their power, and nobody is going to be able to help us. Because if the police decided that they couldn't do anything, then there's nobody that can do anything, you know? And they had taken our phones, everything like this, and they were calling our friends and like harassing them on the phone. They were calling just for fun. They had called my boss, they had called a bunch of my Serbian friends, and they were like, yeah, your friend's going to die. You can look for him in the Sava River and stuff like that. And my friends were freaking out because they knew that this stuff actually happens. And so they were.
So were
really
they
worried.
Calling embassies and trying to?
They were calling the police, and the police were actually looking for us at that point. And possibly that car had also been looking for us, but I think they were just probably trying to pull us over because we were standing on the outside of a friggin' SUV. Right. So people were looking for us at that point, yeah. And they brought us to this, like, this bar that turned out to be kind of like a police informant safe house or something like that. And we showed up, and the bartender was really nice, and he was like, calm down, don't worry, you guys are going to be fine. But he also seemed kind of sketchy in a way, because it's like 9 o'clock in the morning, and there's a bar that like has metal windows and is totally closed, but that guy just happens to be there. What's going on here, you know? Why is this guy hanging out at this place that's like a bar slash house? And so they take us down to the basement, and I'm like, crap, this is a secondary location. I already blew my opportunity to do anything about this. What was I thinking? I'm gonna die now. And we end up in the basement of this place, and there's like pipes sticking out of the wall, wires and stuff. And at this point, though, my friend's annoying these guys, and he's just talking and being rude. And these guys, to me, I was trying to keep really calm and chatty, and they were kind of calm with me, which I thought was really reassuring. And the bartender kept telling my friend, like, hey, man, calm down, chill out, relax. And with me...
How are you being calm and, like, how are you being chatty?
Good question. So the guys would say something like, the cops would say something like, you know, you guys, Americans, all you guys do is screw with our country and, like, bomb us and stuff like that. You're trying to destroy us. We're going to destroy you. We're going to send you back to your CIA friends in a body bag. And I would say something like, hey, look, I totally understand why you feel that way. I would definitely be in the same situation. Americans also are really proud people, but I do just teach English, and a lot of the people I teach are refugees from, and I guess by their accents, they're from Bosnia. So I was like, but again, they didn't know that I knew Serbian. So I said, you know, a lot of my students are from places like Bosnia. I teach kids and adults and things like that. And I mean, you know, if you want to call some of them, you're welcome to use my phone to do so, which I already knew they were doing. And then the guy was like, well, you know what? I don't believe anything you're saying. This is BS. And I was like, yeah, I wouldn't believe me either. So why don't we call some of these people? We can call my boss, who's Serbian. You know, she was part of the resistance, which she actually was back during some of the bombing stuff. She was like a guerrilla fighter in Bosnia, crazy stuff. So I was like, call her. Her name is Gordana. She's in my phone. You can look it up. And her nickname is Goca, which is a common nickname for Gordana. So they actually did call her, and she was like, don't hurt him or I'll kill you, you know? And these guys were like, whatever, biatch, you know, probably didn't care. But then they started to actually be really nice to me in a lot of ways, and they started to get really angry and kick the chair that I was in and things like that. But they were like, what are you going to do? What are you doing here? What are you really doing here? And I just said, look, I'm an English teacher, but I totally get why you're testing me. And they're like, what are you doing today?
So you're constantly trying to relate to them.
Yes.
And somehow kind of get on the same level as them.
Right. And the more emotional they get, the more I'm trying to at least pretend that I'm calm. So if they're kicking the chair and yelling at me and getting in my face and being like, what if I just burn your face with this cigarette right now? I'm like, well, that would really hurt and it would be really mean. And I would say something like just deadpan calm, but not like, oh, don't do that, but just calm. And it was weird and hard to do because inside I'm like, oh my God, I hope they don't stick a cigarette in my eye. You know, that would really hurt and I would scream so loud and they might blind me or whatever. And because that's what they were threatening to do, you know. And they'd already burned some of my arms and stuff like that. Like, they were.
And that hurt?
Yeah, that hurt. And I would be like, ah. And then they would start laughing and I'd be like, okay, I can't really get mad because that's what they want. So I'd be like, you guys are crazy. Knock it off, you know, almost joking. And they were like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? You know, this guy's like weird, but not dislikable.
Were they saying anything in Serbian?
They
that
were.
Point?
Yeah. Good question. They were. They were saying things like, "This guy, you know, he just seems really chill." And then the other guy's like, "Maybe it's spy training." And they're like, "Well, maybe, but he does know a lot of things about, you know, refugees in Bosnia and stuff like that." And then they were like, "All right, well." You know, they have these stereotypes of Americans, so they're like, ask him what his favorite Serbian food is. So they're like, what do you eat? And I was like, well, I heard this place has the best, this type of food, so we're going to go there later if you guys want to come with us. And the guy was like, what? You know, it just totally non-compute, like non-sequiturs left and right to kind of throw off his emotional state. because I figured if I have to make him think, it's so hard to be angry and think at the same time.
That's a really good point.
Because it's logic versus emotion, right? So I wanted to get him out of an emotional state and into a logical state. And I said something like, we're going to this place, Lipa, do you know it? And he's like, yeah, yeah. And I said, I heard they have the best food in Novi Sad. And he's like, no, they don't. They don't have the best food. So he's angry about that instead of angry about me being an American spy. And then I was like, well, what about this place, Nakpitanyan, Belgrade, another place? And he's like, yeah, yeah, it's overrated. There's other places that have better food. And I was like, well, where do you go? He tells me where he goes to eat. I forgot the name, or I'd tell you. And I said, what do you order when you go there? And he tells me, well, do you like this? Do you like that? And I said, yeah, I like this, the sarma, Serbian traditional food. And he goes, you've never had that. And I go, yeah, actually, my grandma makes it because she's from around here, and which is a lie, but whatever. And then he goes, oh, so you're kind of Serbian? And I was like, yeah, I guess technically I've never thought about that way, which is also BS. I just wanted to see, to let him know he was maybe going to hurt one of his maybe native sons if he decided to be all nationalist, because he was being nationalist, you know, I thought, look, if you want to harm an American, just pick somebody else. You know, I'm essentially descended from Serbs, which is not true. And so he gets really, really logical, but he's trying to keep himself angry because it's really, you know, that his plan was to cause some trouble. My friend, on the other hand, is getting his ass beat in the next room, and there
you could hear it.
I could hear it. Like, you hear like, you know, and then you hear like, ugh, and screaming and yelling, and then like, you know, and I'm like, that's what it sounds like when you're getting punched in the face. So, or slapped really hard. And so I'm worried about him, but it's kind of like the airplane mask. Help yourself before you try to aid others. And the guy asked me if I've ever had Serbian rakia, which is like their homemade liquor. And I said, yeah, actually I have. And I go, and I could use a drink right about now as a joke. And he actually got up and went away. And I thought, okay, I'm going to run away or jump this guy when he gets back. And then we're going to have to like get out of here and steal the Jeep and go or something. So he comes back and he's holding like a club or something in his hand. And I'm at this point, I'm like, all right, I'm kind of untied from this chair. I'm going to get up and just tackle him and go for the legs. But then if I go for the legs, he's got this club. So maybe I'll go for a high tackle. And then I was like, wait, I got to control this weapon that he's got. And by the time
any kind of like attack, like, are you into karate or martial arts or anything like that?
At that point, I was doing mixed martial arts. This is 2000. We didn't call it mixed martial arts at this point. We just called it kihon, which is like some Japanese word that means basic or something. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to control the weapon and then I'm going to like take him down somehow and choke him out or you know, twist him up or something. And I was in relatively good shape at that point. But by the time I had come up with that little plan, I realized he was holding a bottle of rakia, this homebrew liquor. And I thought, he's not going to hit me in the head with that. That would be wasteful, you know? And so he puts it down on the table and he starts pouring drinks. And his friend's like, what are you doing over there? You guys having a party? And he's like, ah, whatever. This guy's fine. He's not a spy, whatever. So we start doing shots and drinking. And I'm like, okay, I got to stay relatively sober because if I'm just wasted, they could figure out that they changed their mind and they want to kill us anyway. So at some point I'm like, hold on. I need water. I'm not feeling well. I've been awake all night. We're drinking. Like, I'm really not feeling well. I don't want to throw up. And I noticed there are a lot of pipes sticking out of the wall. I know there's no water anywhere near there. So I thought he's going to go get a bottle of water and then I'm just going to like gun it and run out and figure something out. And then after a while, he just didn't come back. His friend also, I didn't hear any noise. And then I heard the doors, the Jeep closing and them leaving. And I don't know where they were going. I don't know if they were going to get water, if they just got bored with us or what. And the bartender was nowhere to be found either. So me and my friend, I pick him up. He's like all bleeding. It's a huge mess, lumpy, like unconscious mess. Barely. I mean, he was like, it was barely. Mm. So I'm dragging him out and I don't want to go out the front door. So we're trying to find a side door because who knows if they're just out there chilling in the Jeep. I don't know. And I noticed they were actually out there in the Jeep, but we had gotten out the side door. We start running away. We start getting away. And then we immediately get arrested again because we had gone to a cafe to ask for help. And I assume at this point we're covered in blood, like dirty, beat up. You know, I'd had burns and those things were like kind of bloody and gross on my face and arms. And then I assume the waitress who came over to see what we needed was just like two freaking zombies walked in and she probably called the cops because we had sat down in some chairs and couldn't move. So the cops came and they arrested us again. And they took us to the police station. These are real cops. And they were like, "Who, you know, what are you guys doing?" I'm like, "The police did this." And they were like, "Bullshit, what police?" And I described the Jeep and I described what happened. And then the guy goes, this big, tough cop with like combat boots and cargo pants and like a little submachine gun. They call them militia, like militia, like real cops, like SWAT-ish type guys. He goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry about this." And he just felt awful. Because he's like, these freaking guys, that these stupid secret police guys are always just causing crap in the community. And these two guys who are clearly just tourists just got the bad end of that. And he felt really bad. And he's a young guy who is really not happy when we got arrested. He thought we were just junkies or something. So he was super apologetic. And he's telling the captain what happened. They throw us in a cell and the captain's like, "What on earth? What is going on here?" My Serbian wasn't good enough to explain to him in coherent terms what happened, but his girlfriend was a German teacher. So he calls his girlfriend on the phone, and I tell her what happened in German. I can speak German much better than I can speak Serbian. It's my second language. And I tell her what happened. She happens to know my boss because she's a language teacher, and they had some conference or whatever, and she knows who my boss is because she owns a language school. So she explains to the captain what happened, and he's like, "Okay, I'm just going to lose you guys. I didn't book you guys. Just get the hell out of here. If you can, leave the town that we're in, Novi Sad, because I just don't want to deal with this crap. But I'm going to send a detective over to get a statement anyway, because you guys are in bad shape and I don't want to ignore you, but I certainly don't want you sitting here." And so we got out of there and we left, and the detective tried to figure out what happened. And those guys turned out to be guys they just couldn't do anything about, made front page news. And
really, made front page news
in Serbia. I got calls from my friends in Australia that are Serbian that were like, "Are you okay? I just saw you on the front page of Politico."
Wasn't it dangerous being on the front page? Like, one of these guys try to get revenge?
Yeah, I thought, great, oh, this is perfect. But what happened was, we went to the embassy and they were like, "Look, we'll take care of it. It's not going to be a problem." So we got a letter of apology from their interior minister that we were allowed to read at the embassy that we couldn't take because they didn't want some admission of like, "Hey,
oh, I was going to ask if you like framed that."
Hell no. I would have, but they wouldn't let us take it out of the embassy because they were like, "Look, we don't want some admission of how effed up our country is floating around, but you guys can know that we apologized to your government, but not to you, for the miscommunication between what you were doing here as an educational resource and not a spy." And I was freaking pissed because I thought the American embassy didn't do squat. They were just like, "Don't go to the media and make a big deal out of it."
Yeah, so, meanwhile, you're on the front page.
Meanwhile, I'm on the front page. Wasn't even my fault. And then the educational program that I was with, they said, "Look, we totally know that this probably happened, but we're going to have to say that it was all a misunderstanding because we don't want, it's already hard enough to get shit done in this country. And if you guys are putting gum in our machinery by making a big deal out of this, it's going to be a huge pain in the ass. So either you go home right now and you lose your fellowship and we say that we had to remove you from the program for bad conduct, or you just like deal with the fact that you're still alive and like deal with it and we'll give you like extra money to."
They gave you extra money.
They gave me extra money.
Like how much?
It was like $8,000 or something.
It's
like,
not bad considering you're making 100 euros a
yeah,
month.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. They had ended up paying for like everything that I needed on this fellowship.
But did you get any kind of like post-traumatic stress from this?
I think maybe I did for a while but I didn't know it at the time because it wasn't in the consciousness at the time, like what PTSD is or was. So there were definitely some times where I like would have weird nightmares or something, or where I would just be like really angry for no reason, probably because you just feel violated. And yeah, like it's probably the same kind of stress that you would have if you got mugged and you got beat up and somebody broke your jaw and you just like never knew who it was. Hmm. Or they never got caught.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Imagine bold, naturally aged Tillamook cheddar slices melting over a burger, eating handfuls of thick-cut cheddar shreds straight from the bag, taking a bite out of an irresistibly bold block of extra sharp cheddar cheese. We know you want to get back to streaming, but wasn't it nice to daydream about cheese for a bit? Tillamook Cheddar, extraordinary dairy.
So you said earlier, you made reference to a kidnapping in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've never been kidnapped once, of course.
Yeah.
And you've been kidnapped twice. Like, so I want to hear about the kidnapping in Mexico, but what do you think about you makes you kidnapped?
Well,
twice is a lot.
Twice
is a lot.
It's
like getting struck by lightning.
It is kind of like getting struck by lightning. The first time was in Mexico, and I was 20, and I lived in this, like, hood barrio where I had found a place to live because I worked for a nonprofit. And
So it seems like you put yourself in... For what ostensibly seems like charitable reasons,
yeah.
You put yourself in what are already not necessarily secondary locations, but let's call them 1.5 locations.
Yeah, it's 1.5 locations.
Yeah.
I was doing that at that time. Now that I'm 36,
trying to self-sabotage in some way? Like,
maybe.
Did you feel like your childhood was suburban, boring, and
yes.
Now you were going to kind of like take
totally.
Chances and have, you know, these experiences?
Yeah, I grew up only child. Did a lot of cool stuff, but only after age maybe 16, no, 17. Because I had been grown up in this boring suburban town of Troy, Michigan. And then I was an exchange student in Germany when I was 17. And they had placed me in the former East Germany, which is like, you know, former communist place. And I lived in this kind of rough town with this family. And they were awesome. And the father taught me kind of how to hustle a little bit. Because whenever you grow up in a communist society, either you're just a downtrodden sheep or you kind of realize, all right, here's how the system works. You got to finagle everything.
So like, what's an example of a hustle?
So one of the things he finagled was I needed to get a visa to stay there for a year and go to school. And the organization that I was with, they were like, oh, we submitted all the paperwork. The problem is you can't go on any trips around until we finish all this paperwork because we need to know where you are because you're going to stay here and we don't want immigrants like disappearing into the country. So you have to stay around. And my host father was like, this is Germany. We don't bribe people. It's really on the up and up. But I happen to know this person who does this thing at this police department. I'm just going to explain to him that you're an American and that you're staying with me and that I'll keep track of you. And so he went in there and he was like, hey, such and such police officer guy. Remember me? I was your gym teacher from when you're in high school. Anyway, I've got this exchange student and you should also come on this ski trip with us later. And the guy was like, yeah, I don't know if I can go on the ski trip, but I'll give you a call. And don't worry, here's his sticker. He's good. And we'll just do the paperwork after. But he's got the sticker for now, as long as he's just like staying in your house. And so that was like a pretty simple little hustle. But I was like, wow, how did you do that? That's pretty cool they let you do that, because I thought Germany was really strict. And he started telling me that in the communist times, when he got his driver's license, it took like 8 months and you had to pay all this money and it was really hard and not everybody could have a driver's license and even fewer people could have a car. So what he did is he contacted his cousin who lived in Canada, had him cut the labels off a bunch of jeans, like Levi's jeans, had him mail the jeans in a box marked Christmas presents or whatever to him, to my host father. And he also had him send a bunch of whiskey along with the jeans. So he would take the jeans and the whiskey and he would go to the driving instruction place that made you take 6 months of whatever driving instruction. And he'd go, look, guys, I already know how to drive. Here's proof. Here's a bottle of Jack Daniels and a pair of jeans. And they were like, okay, we'll just give you the test. So he drove in the car and they're like, yeah, I guess you kind of do know how to drive. All right, here's a stamp that says you took the driving test. So you go to the police. The police have to kind of recognize that you took the test and process all the paperwork so you can get the license. And he goes, look, I could use this driver's license a bit earlier. Here's a couple bottles of whiskey and a couple of pairs of jeans for your kids or, you know, for you guys. And they go, all right, we'll expedite this. And when you come back, have another bottle of whiskey and another pair of those jeans. So he goes, great, come back in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, he got a driver's license. Usually this process lasts almost a year or longer than a year.
So it's almost like bribery, but not quite. It's like gift giving.
It's like gift giving because the money's not worth squat. You can't buy anything in communist societies. There's nothing to buy.
Right.
So if you have the product, it's better than money, which is pretty rare. So those cops couldn't get jeans or whiskey. It was impossible to get that stuff. And he's like, look, I just need a driver's license. What does it cost you to stamp a piece of paper that you already know I know how to drive? The driving people already told you I knew how to drive. So he got a license and I thought, wait a minute, this is amazing. I wonder if everything works like that. And that was kind of the dawn where I was like, wait a minute, people play by the rules if they don't know how to not. And that was a huge realization for me.
What do you mean? People play by the rules.
If they don't know how to not play by the rules, if they don't know a better way.
Right.
So like in America, for example, you see people who are like, they grow up and they go to college and then they get a job. But people who kind of maybe have an alternate way of looking at things, they might grow up, go to high school and go, I don't really know what I want to do, but I do know this person who's running a company doing this thing. Maybe I can get an apprenticeship or an internship there. Actually learn something instead of like the skull shapes of australopithecines or whatever I learned in college. And then later on, I can either go back to school or I can get a job or I can do a startup or something like that, or I can work with these people at this cool company. But you need connections to do that. And so what I learned is that connections are really, really important. And they were important in that communist society, but they probably were equally important now. It's just that since people have predefined paths that they can choose that supposedly lead to gainful employment and a happy life, we don't necessarily look for those opportunities. We just look for the default path, which is grow up, go to university, apply for jobs, get mediocre job, work until ... dream job, ... marriage life, happy kids, family, whatever. That's a black box for all of us, right? But I thought maybe there's alternate paths that we can carve out. And I learned that from watching him kind of get what he wanted and needed through alternate means rather than just filling out the application.
So, okay, so from there, now you're in Mexico.
Yes.
In a hood somewhere.
And this one's less exciting because I basically had lived in a crappy area. I wanted to go meet my friend who is German for some drinks in the town. So I got into a cab, a green Volkswagen Bug taxi, and that's what they are all in Mexico City. And so I get in this taxi, and this is before cell phones. This is like the year 2000, right? So there's cell phone, no cell phones, and cab drivers didn't have them. So we're driving further and further away. And Mexico City is like a bowl where in the middle is the center of town. And that's where I wanted to go. It's called Zócalo. And it's like the presidential palace. There's a statue there. I mean, everyone knows where it is. And he goes, yeah, I'm just maybe, I thought he was avoiding traffic. He goes, maybe I'm asking for directions, something like that. And I thought, this is weird because him asking for directions to Zócalo from here is like a cabbie in Washington, D.C. asking for directions to the White House. Everybody knows where it is. It's suspicious if they don't. So I noticed we were going further away from the bowl, and I'd asked him, and he said, we're looking, you know, I'll get directions. I'm going to go to ask my friend. And I thought, I'm good. Just let me out here. And he goes, well, no, we're almost there. And I was like, I know we're not almost there. So at this point, I said, look, I'll pay you. Just let me out. I'll go back. And he was like, I thought you said you only had a credit card, because I did stupidly, I was 20 years old, tell him I needed to go to an ATM beforehand. Just like, don't do that. So, because I didn't have any cash to pay him. So he goes, look, I thought you said you didn't have a credit, any cash. We got to go to an ATM. I know where one is. And I thought, there's for sure no ATMs further away than away from the city. There's ATMs down where we're going, man. You know, what the hell? So he stops in front of this like gross ramshackle building that's all cinder block, like raw cinder block. And I go, don't get out of the car. And at this point, I'd been like lifting weights and bodybuilding and doing MMA and all this stuff. So I slid behind him. I was sort of kitty corner in the behind the passenger seat. I slid behind him and I put my arm between him and the door. And he didn't know that. He didn't notice that. So I said, don't get out of the cab. Just keep going anywhere but here. Because I'm like, this is the secondary location, right? Mm-hmm. This is for sure there. I cannot stay here. And
I don't understand. You put your arm... Describe it to me again.
So you know there's like the door, and then there's the the driver's seat. My arm was between, like touching the door.
Like his arm was on the wheel, and your arm was in between his arm and the door.
Right. So he wouldn't have been able to, if he had wanted to jump out. My idea was, if he wanted to jump out of the car, he would have had to like get through my arm. And I thought maybe I can catch him or delay him somehow. And he was probably in his 50s, and I was 20, and I was like,
what if he went out the other side?
He would have had to go over the emergency brake and the console. Uh-huh. So I would have probably been able to slide faster than him.
Right.
But I couldn't get out of the car, and the locks had dipped below. They were like, oh, it was an old crappy VW bug. So the locks had dipped below the surface level of the door. So I couldn't pull them up.
Right.
And I was really frustrated. I couldn't open the door, nothing. And I thought about like breaking the window, but I didn't know if I could even get out then. I wasn't sure what was going on. So I slid between him and the door, and I thought, okay, I'm probably scared over nothing, but I don't want to take any chances. So I had my arm between him and the door, and he goes, calm down, calm down, calm down. He didn't see my arm there. And then he made a fast one for the door, trying to like charge out. So I grabbed him up and pulled him really tight against the seat, and I slid my arms up around his neck. Before he was able to really get around, and he was flailing and like scratching on my arms, but I had just squeezed the crap out of him from the neck, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna just put him in a sleeper between the seat, which is actually, it's really hard to put someone in a sleeper.
What's a sleeper?
A sleeper is when you have your forearm around their neck and you're cutting off these two vessels on either side of the neck, the blood supply to the brain. So you have about 4 seconds or so before you just start seeing red or black and you go to sleep for a few seconds anyway. So I put him in the sleeper hold. It's very hard because the seat padding you really have to squeeze hard, even if it's your body against their body and your arms against their neck. I've got a seat in between me and him. So I'm squeezing really, really hard. And you know, I can't get a great grip on his neck because there's a seat pad, like a headrest between me and him. So I'm squeezing as hard as I can. And eventually he stops moving. And at that point, I'm able to open his door, and I'm like pushing him out of the car, climbing between the two seats, sliding out the driver's side door. I eventually pull his body away from the car, and I try to drive the car, and it's a freaking sticky stick shift.
Now, wait a second. Let's say something bad wasn't really happening.
I know.
And let's say
I think about that all the time.
Let's say someone in this place saw what was happening. Now you're like assaulting someone and stealing their car.
I know.
And his buddies are presumably stronger than him. They would kill you.
Yeah, I was really worried about that. And I still think about that to this day. Like, what if he really was just going to ask for directions, and I just like assaulted a taxi driver and hopefully he's still alive, right? And then, like, tried to steal his car. I couldn't steal the car. I couldn't drive this cranky old 1960 whatever VW bug. I couldn't do it. So I took the keys out and I chucked him. I probably should have kept him with me, but I chucked him because I didn't want him to wake up or somebody else to, like, get in the car and drive after me. And I'm just running down this, like, crappy dirt road, or maybe it wasn't totally dirt. It was, like, rough pavement-ish crap. And I'm running and running and running. And I'm, like, in freaking Banana Republic chinos and, like, a blue button-down shirt. And at this point, I had, like, my hair dyed blonde. I was 20. I'm 36 now. I looked a lot different. And I'm running down the road, and no one's driving by. Finally, I get to a bigger road. No one's stopping because there's this, like, sweaty white gringo who is looking pretty gross, I would imagine, and not in the right place. I don't think anybody would stop there anyway, let alone for somebody looking like me at that point. Finally, someone stops and is like, "What's wrong?" in Spanish. And I was like, I think I got kidnapped, and I don't know how to say that in Spanish. And I'm just saying, like, somebody took me. And they're like, "What?" So this guy turned out to be a doctor, and a girl I thought was his daughter, but I actually think was maybe his girlfriend. She was like, "Well, we can't leave him here. We can't leave him here." And I was like, "Look, I'll ride in the trunk. I don't care. I'll ride in the trunk. I don't care." So they ended up being like, okay, fine. We're not driving you home, but we'll drive you to a metro station. So they drove me to a metro station, and I was like, "Take me to the police." And the guy goes, "Look, I'm not taking you to the police because, one, I don't know what you did. Two, if you did get kidnapped, there's a chance the police are like in on whatever ring did this, because there's a lot of corrupt police in Mexico City, especially at that time. They're like, you could end up getting put right back here. If I were you, I would not go to the police. I would just go and get all your crap and get the hell out of here, and don't be around by tomorrow morning. Just move." So I did. I moved.
Where'd you go?
I went to Guadalajara, Mexico, which is another city, and that was much quieter. And I rented a house from a family there, and I was just chill. I probably should have left Mexico entirely, but I thought, nobody knows who I was. I didn't get the taxi in front of my house, so nobody knows. And I just
emailed. It wasn't like they were targeting you. You just looked like a target.
I just looked like a target. I was just a dumb kid. And I told my host family, I was like, I had to move because I had a problem with some people there. And they were like, "Oh my gosh, thanks for not coming home," because they know, like, I don't want a friggin' Mexican gang at our house.
Right.
With my elderly parents. I lived with, like, this random elderly people and their kids. They're adult kids. So they were like, "All right, fine."
So, okay. So now we see a range of ways to get out of a hostage situation.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.